Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Catch the biggest live Premier League games every weekend on Sky Sports.
You're very welcome back. So 71 minutes gone. It's Atletico 2, Liverpool 2 in Madrid this evening. The football show on Off the Ball brought to you by Sky. All the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports. The Ronaldo discussion, Dan, I'm curious for your thoughts on this. So it hasn't been a good time for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I'd say you've noticed that of late.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to go somewhere else with the Manchester United discussion, to be honest. Like, how many times in one given year can you have the Ole discussion? I'm done with it. I mean, I'm not done with it because I know it's going to be up Saturday, Tuesday, you know, until whenever. But let's talk about something else, but it's on the same team.
Well, it's actually, it's quite an interesting issue for him. It's the Ronaldo problem, I suppose, and it feels a touch unsolvable if your starting point is Ronaldo is going to start. So Michael Cox, for instance, in The Athletic caught my eye because he was writing about the intricacies of the tactical situation. So in short, just to briefly surmise, take pressing, for instance, what United are trying to do without the ball. So the statistics of most pressing actions per 90 minutes in the Premier League thus far. Top of the pile, Wilfred Zaha, take about 20 times per 90 minutes he is in your face, followed by Diogo Jota, he's at 19.8. Someone like Aubameyang is at 14. Salah, in fairness, the man is busy scoring wonder goals, so he's doing 12 and that's not bad. Mane, 10.5. All the way down the very, 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 very bottom, and there's a bit of a gap from him to the next batch, it's Ronaldo at 2.7 times per match. So 2.7 times per match, Ronaldo will look at Mason Greenwood and say, right, I mean, it really looks like we should press here. Come on, let's go. If I'm going, you're going. So there was a couple of graphics which showed as well, when the pressing does happen, there's no tactic behind it. So for instance, there's no sending a player in possession down a certain avenue that we've in advance decided where, when I press this player, it's to send him that way because we're going to set trap. This is how fairly basic pressing happens. And he used examples where Ronaldo and Greenwood did press one of the Leicester centre-backs, but Greenwood kind of trotted up, didn't know which way he wanted to send him. In the end, it's an easy pass to the left wing-back who's outside of Greenwood, and away they go up the field, and Leicester kept doing that. And so on the one hand, you'd say, well, that's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. If Greenwood doesn't know which way he's meant to press, then that's on him. But I guess the bigger problem is they don't have a pressing tactic because they know with Ronaldo in the team, they can't do it. And so this is obviously a huge issue. And then the other big problem is that Ronaldo's arrival means that the plan, which had been working okay, Pogba on the left of a three in front of the two midfielders, you've now got Greenwood, who you have to facilitate. He moved from nine to wing. You've got Sancho. You paid 70 million for him. Kind of have to start integrating him into the team. Yeah. You still have Rashford there. I mean, Cavani, it's like, best of luck to you. That's probably not going to happen. And therefore, Pogba is going back to that two in midfield. And that just hasn't and will not work. And allied to that, so Michael Cox was making the point, United's formation is basically a 4-2-4 a lot of the time with them. On Saturday, it was Matic and Pogba with acres in front of them and a front four doing very little work. And then behind them, and Damien Delaney made this point last night, Maguire is worried a touch about his pace and being caught. So he's just dropping back that 5 or 10 yards more than he should. So suddenly, and like, I'm no fan of Pogba in that position, but suddenly Pogba and Matic, for instance, as the two the other day, have got nothing going on in front of them, huge gaps. And then behind them, they turn around when passes are slipped by them. And there's a huge gap back to Harry Maguire and co. And, I mean, Michael Cox's contention wasn't, I think it's fair enough. How do you solve this without dropping some really, really big names? And for a start, having Ronaldo and Pogba in that team is getting very, very tricky. And Fernandes is running more as well. But, I mean, he's doing a lot of running to compensate for Ronaldo. And it's not all that effective. It's not his natural game. And one final point he made, Ronaldo's previous Manchester United, Real Madrid, Juventus, Portugal sides have been, to varying extents, structured to cover for him. If he played on the left, the opposite winger would tuck inside more. If he played up front, the wide players or number 10 would play deeper than they might have expected. When Ronaldo leaves, others like Rooney and Benzema go up a level because they're no longer playing second fiddle. But Manchester United are not successfully covering for him. Without possession, they're neither one thing or the other. They don't drop off successfully and just form a compact block, nor do they press, and the consequence is the opposition plays easily through them. Now, that's a lot to solve for Atalanta tomorrow and Liverpool on Sunday and beyond. Like,
yeah, and then you don't play Ronaldo in a game and it's like, well, Alex Ferguson says you should always start your best players.
Yeah.
You know, when actually there are times when you need that. And it's like, it is, I suppose, to reference something I've seen recently, like you see Portugal play Ireland recently, and you can actually see why. Apart from the fact Ronaldo then like scores two late goals, which is obviously a bit of a very crucial asterisk to the whole point.
Yeah, great but goals, and against Villarreal.
Yeah, like, no, amazing, and he will do it. But you know, if you're a team that wants to try and play out from the back, and maybe you're vulnerable to a really aggressive press because it can ask some questions of you, you know, it's not so bad to have Ronaldo on the opposite side, and you can see how teams are quite naturally going to capitalise on this as a tactic, you know, because there's so much focus now that teams will play the top sides in the Premier League, and they will expect that type of treatment from their forward players. You've given the stats there pretty clearly of what the sort of you know, the market expectation is at the moment for that. So if you suddenly play a team like that, and it's funny, Portugal sometimes end up with the four strikers as well, and then it just creates gaps further back that aren't actually, as Ireland actually found out that night, if you can just clip the ball, it's not actually that hard to suddenly find space opening very quickly. And it does go back to that central figure. But to be fair, this was flagged at the time when he signed. And I mean, without making it an Ole thing, I mean, you always got the sense that maybe he wasn't 100% jumping up and down about this deal, because he probably saw this coming over the hill.
Yeah.
And
it's a big nettle to grasp
now. It's a real problem for a team that sort of at times, you know, in recent seasons, people would have spoke about maybe pace on the break as being one of their weapons, you know, and that's where they could actually hurt teams at times. Whereas now, I mean, like, just watching the Leicester game at the weekend, it was just striking. They were nothing really. Like, you know, they were sort of, they weren't a team that was madly cavalier, but they were, because they weren't, as you said, there wasn't a mad aggressive press up front, but they were also quite easy to play through, you know, for Leicester players. So they were neither one or the other, and they ended up getting the result and the sort of performance that you would expect. So, but what do you do?
I mean,
it's a commercial. There was a commercial element to decision aside from the obvious football logic.
It feels like they're doomed, or else Solskjaer, if he grasps the nettle being Pogba and or Ronaldo, maybe Ronaldo first and Pogba second. If he grasps it, he basically has to win every game. You know, there's very little room there for...
Oh, yeah. He doesn't have credit in the bank to sustain. We've been through this before.
If he wins the game, then it's like, well, look, it's worked this time. I think he has to go on a hell of a run if he's going to take these sacred cows out.
Yeah. It's outscoring teams. It's looking for that sort of special teams result from your special players all the time. As I said, as people who've watched him more regularly would say, they're just relying on great players to do great things as opposed to it being sort of any coherent part of coherent plan bringing them there.
Mo Salah has scored a penalty for Liverpool. They are 3-2 up with 12 minutes to go against Atletico Madrid. Dan, relations between Bohemians and Shamrock Rovers are interesting.
Not great. So wouldn't traditionally have been great, but I was at the game last night in Tala. And to be honest, the season is sort of drifting away that Rovers have the league pretty much wrapped up, and you know the Bows games are good, but there's not a huge amount happening with the league in a way. It's like Rovers are going to win the league. There's a very interesting race for Europe. But this sort of, the relations between the clubs are not great right now. And one of the aspects of the game last night was that there was no away fans there in the ground, which you do miss from the derby. Like, a derby is about two sets of fans, not one. And without going down the road of whataboutery, there has been situations in recent weeks in the League of Ireland where clubs, citing restricted attendances, have said, we're not letting away fans in because we want more of our fans to be there, which is fine. But what we've had subsequently tonight is Bowes release a statement saying they were very disappointed not to have fans at the game last night, pointing out that Tala is a big stadium, there's room for them there. And they've said, next month, Rovers are coming to Daily Mount. None of your fans are coming to the game.
It's a bit petty.
And there's been instances around the games. Rovers very unhappy with the treatment of players and officials at Bowes. I think you'll hear stories from the other side. It's got pretty, like, it's always been nasty, but I don't think, sometimes, like, you'll have rivalries and it's between the fan bases, but the, you know, the club officials will always get on quite well. Like, even Celtic Rangers, they'd share sponsors and they'd almost play the game and work together. You see the Premier League clubs, you know, you know, officials will work together at a certain level. But Bowes Rovers, I think it's almost, I'd say that the rivalry in the boardroom is probably stronger than it is on the pitch almost,
right, okay.
in some ways, you know. Some of the players will get on quite well, but not the officials.
Okay, so, we'll watch that space and see if that decision is reversed. I know Rob Harris from Associated Press is waiting for us patiently. Hi, Rob.
Hi, good evening.
Yeah, great to have you with us once again. So this Saudi takeover at Newcastle has dominated really over the last 10 days. And then on Sunday, it all became very, very real. Your take on how this is going to play out over the next while? To what extent will the Premier League be sitting uncomfortably and on the receiving end of criticism, or will this all just dissolve fairly quickly?
Yeah, I mean, the criticism is growing, particularly from some of Newcastle's rivals. And even when you refer to it as the Saudi takeover, amazingly, we've still got the actual consortium pushing back on any reference to it being a Saudi-owned operation. If we think back to a couple of weeks ago, that Premier League statement when they said that they approved the new ownership because they passed the owners and directors test because they got those legally binding guarantees, the fact that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was not in control of Newcastle United. Obviously, it's quite easy to look on the company website of the entity that now owns 80% of Newcastle, the Public Information Fund. So the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, it's on a Saudi government website. The chairman of the board is Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia. You've got six government ministers. You've got a member of the royal court. And then the governor, who is now the chairman, the non-executive chairman of Newcastle United. And we've got still questions from other Premier League clubs about just why this takeover was approved. Just why did they even need those legally binding guarantees to claim there's a separation between the state and the club? And now the latest move is to try to effectively stop Newcastle striking sponsorship deals with other Saudi-related companies.
Yes, I saw Manchester City abstain from that vote.
They did. Manchester City themselves did get legal advice. They took into the meeting. They believe that this Premier League club's decision would be seeing the league act as a cartel, because what we saw was the 18 clubs back a proposal, which is now temporary for a few weeks, that will stop related party transactions by clubs. So Manchester City over the last decade have amassed a lot of Abu Dhabi-linked sponsorship, the Etihad being on the shirts, on the stadium name as well. They say at fair value. So what they would get at market rates if they went to a non-Abu Dhabi company. But clearly, you've got the concerns of the 18. The fact Newcastle will rapidly strike deals with other Saudi entities to boost the revenue so they can comply with the Premier League's financial regulations. But certainly Manchester City thinking it would see the league acting anti-competitively like a cartel if they tried to restrict which sponsorship deals could be struck, Newcastle voting against. No official word from the Premier League. This all gleaned from sources, and some questioning the lack of visibility of the chief executive, Richard Masters, in terms of presenting the Premier League viewpoint in the last couple of weeks and just how all these decisions have come about.
I mean, Rob, I mean, from your sources, as much as you're aware, I mean, is there a sense of the strength of feeling within those 18 clubs? I mean, you know, 18 are pooling together, but is there a sense of who's leading the fight on this? Like, who are the particularly aggrieved clubs? Is there any awareness of who's actually to the forefront of it?
Well, one person who has spoken out publicly is Jurgen Klopp from Liverpool, in his position as manager rather than any of the leadership there, of course. And he's, you know, been critical of a state now owning a club. Maybe he's looking enviously at some of the investment they might have to spend on players, given his limited resources last summer, although the club would point to, obviously, players tied down to new deals. Obviously, seeing tonight going well for them, leading 3-2 at Atletico Madrid at the moment. So Liverpool certainly have got objections from Klopp about Richard Masters not being vocal in terms of explaining just why this takeover was approved. And they, you know, I suppose they fear unfettered, unrestricted spending potentially by them, which is creates a new rival in trying to sign players. You know, I was there at St James's Park on Sunday for the game against Tottenham, and certainly the way they did fall apart to lose 3-2 shows that's a relegation fight they're in at the moment, and a struggle even with all that cash in terms of who they could attract in the January transfer window.
Rob, what was the atmosphere like at that game, or what were you hearing and seeing? Because it was just a fairly extraordinary afternoon, I think, certainly looking in on television. But, I mean, being there and hearing what people are saying about it all, and I don't know, the nature of debate, if there even was debate, I'd be very curious to get your sense of what it was like on that Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, there are a few elements of it to separate, being inside the ground itself, inside the game, particularly in the first 2 minutes, of course, when they took the lead through Callum Wilson. Then was an absolutely electric atmosphere. There was pre-match as well, a real sort of excitement in the air, positivity. Indeed, the only negativity really through the afternoon was aimed at Steve Bruce when they were obviously chanting for him to be sacked, and he still does remain in post at the moment. So very much focused on Bruce, the individual, rather than the team. But then outside, that was where it was incredibly curious. A lot of fans dressed up in mock Arab headdress and robes, which certainly can be seen as particularly offensive in terms of cultural appropriation. No sense from the new ownership that they're sort of speaking out against that. We'll kick it out, intervene. The suggestions there involved to maybe encourage fans to stop dressing up like that. So you saw many dressed up drinking Newcastle brown ale when I was sort of speaking to them. And the matters of human rights did come up. I was speaking to a fan, and he actually pointed out behind me, driving by, was a Justice for Jamal Khashoggi billboard on a van. We were just talking about how he feels about the takeover. Then he said, we're going to get things like that. And he pointed to it. So some might think it was us as the media just bringing it up with fans. Certainly the fans are recognising that it exists as an issue. Yeah. And it's a moral conflict that they are dealing with. In many cases, they're just trying to sort of celebrate the fact that, you know, they have some hope again in terms of the potential for the team where there wasn't the spending under Mike Ashley. So that's what they certainly hope for, better times. But with that, they're going to have to accept the association with a country that Amnesty certainly does not necessarily believe should be owning a Premier League club. And, you know, there were some Saudi fans as well out there I spoke to, again, as the Khashoggi billboard was going by, which made it relevant to bring up with them. And I posted the videos on my social media at Rob Harris on Twitter for people to actually see how the exchanges did unfold. And, you know, one Saudi who was a student, so certainly educated, was saying, that's fake news. And when I tried to sort of ask him what aspect of it was fake news about Khashoggi, couldn't really say, you know, as I obviously pointed out, well, we are obviously seeing evidence presented to us by the likes of US intelligence investigations from the government there. And, you know, some of them want to sort of distance themselves from it being a Saudi project. Others very much thankful of the role of Saudi Arabia in rescuing Newcastle. And, you know, some fans spoke to maybe thinking, actually, we're, you know, then necessarily not going to sort of glorify Saudi Arabia while taking the investment. So, you know, they're going to have to face those questions, the moral conflicts in terms of the role of Mohammed bin Salman and the human rights abuses, focus on the anti-LGBTQ laws in Saudi Arabia, that conflict again with Newcastle pushing out those messages of being open, free and discrimination, particularly as we're at the moment in the 2 weeks of no room for racism in the Premier League. Newcastle themselves investigating an incident of discrimination from their own fans towards Tottenham fans as well during the game. But, you know, many Newcastle fans would say they don't decide who the owners are, you know, but they certainly haven't protested against them. And, you know, they point out the fact the British government, of course, continues to have dealings with the Saudi state. Just last Monday, we had Boris Johnson as Prime Minister speaking to Mohammed bin Salman on a call. So, you know, that shows that close association. And it's all about, effectively, are we asking sport to adopt a moral, are we asking sport to adopt a higher moral platform than governments?
Yeah, a lot of those arguments do amount to whataboutery, but as whataboutery arguments go, there's something in them, you know, when they make those points. That is very true when they talk about the strategic alliance with the UK government and Saudi Arabia for a very long time. You know, they're factual points to make. When you say that Richard Masters, the Premier League CEO, has been keeping a low profile, Rob, what do you think is going to be the trickier issue for him? Because the human rights issue has not really, it seems, been an issue for the Premier League. It doesn't seem like they've referenced any concerns. It seems like the biggest concern they had was to make sure that there is, a point of separation between the PIF and Mohammed bin Salman. So they wanted, you know, very clear that actually it's not Mohammed bin Salman who's running this football club. And I suppose that one of Master's worst nightmares might be if some journalist uncovers some documentation to show that actually there's a fairly tight link there between the Saudi royal family, government and the club, which is a distinct possibility, I would think.
Yeah, if we just look at this, and I'm, you know, not getting a view on should the takeover have happened or not, I've just focused actually on some of the process questions really on this, and there's so much to actually unpick on it, as I mentioned, about this claim from the Premier League that there isn't Saudi control, this claim from PIF, the Public Investment Fund, that they aren't Saudi when they are a Saudi government website that they operate on, the entire board is dominated by Saudi government people. And the fact is, just as we imagine the situation with the fact that how does the PIF carrying out its fiduciary duties, its oversight duties for one of its investments, discuss Newcastle? Because as we say, that entire board, the only person on it who is not a member of the government or the royal court is Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who's the new non-executive chairman of Newcastle United. And he likes to be addressed as His Excellency. So everyone does seem to effectively be a government figure while they're saying that the Saudi government does not control the club. So that's the sort of questions that we still have unanswered for Richard Masters, let alone in terms of why they approved the takeover, just how they came to this conclusion that they even needed these legally binding guarantees, how much was the end of the piracy dispute relevant in approving the takeover, because certainly up until last year, the Premier League themselves were lobbying the World Trade Organization, US anti-piracy authorities against the Saudi run operation, implicated operation BOUTQ, which the World Trade Organization found was facilitated by Saudi Arabia. They at least didn't do enough to clamp down on it. And it was piracy in the feeds from Qatar's beIN Sports, which owns those rights, all a proxy in the Middle East Gulf dispute, which really starts to thaw around January time. So there are dealings now between Qatar and its rivals, and the fact you saw beIN Sports outside St. James's Park interviewing Saudis as well. So we're intrigued to know, actually, was that the key stumbling block as we came from the beIN side? And, you know, just why do they need to show a separation between the Saudi state and Newcastle United? Because certainly, you know, from Manchester City, obviously, they are also linked back to Sheikh Mansour as a member of the Abu Dhabi royal family.
Yeah. Okay. Rob, we're out of time, but thanks so much for that. Rob Harris from AP. Cheers, Rob.
Great to speak to you.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky, catch the biggest live Premier League games every weekend on Sky Sports.